Is it austerity 2.0? Tough choices ahead? A rerun of Cameron's Tories? Or are there still little glimmers of hope in a cloudy sky? 2 months or so into Britain's new Labour era, we ask what we should make of Prime Minister Starmer and his team in what has surely been the shortest honeymoon, if there even was one at all, a government has had in recent political history.
We did it! You campaigned for it, you fought for it, you voted for it, and now it has arrived. Change begins now.
With financial markets in turmoil, with interest rates going through the roof, with people's mortgages and rents going through the roof, I'm not willing to take that risk. Economic stability always has to come first. And when you're confronted with a £22 billion black hole that you're not convinced that you can service through additional borrowing, you have to make savings. And that's what I did yesterday.
That's what we've inherited. Not just an economic black hole, a societal black hole. And that's why we have to take action and do things differently. And part of that is being honest with people about the choices that we face, how tough this will be. And frankly, things will get worse before they get better.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. Today we're talking Labour, Britain's new Labour government, after 14 years of frankly horrendous Conservative rule. Millions have celebrated Labour's decisive election victory. But since that fateful July day, the new comms team at number 10 has kicked into action. Their aim, it seems, is a simple one: to get you to put your hopes and dreams away and be as miserable as possible. So what do we make of it all, and what do we expect to happen next?
Hi, this is Seema. I joined Another Europe Is Possible in 2018. For me, the most important thing about this space is building a transnational movement for a more democratic economy, anti-racist politics, and global solidarity beyond nationalism. So that's why I hope you join the Another Europe Is Possible family too. Go to anothereurope.org/join and sign up to get access to an extended version of this podcast.
Zoe, this is an uncomfortable topic for us. I voted for Starmer. I mean, my joke is that I've only ever voted for the winning candidate in a Labour leadership election, so you can absolutely blame me for everything that's happened since 2010. But you were really quiet. You didn't just vote for Starmer. I mean, you were really quite involved. So at this stage, like, it might be good just to go back to the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, I'm chary of trying to accrue too much credit to myself, because there are a lot of people in the concentric circles around the Labour Party who, according to them, were absolute linchpins in Starmer's leadership campaign. And I wouldn't want to sound like a blowhard. But for sure, I was very committed to his leadership. I helped him insofar as I was able. Like, I had a dinner for him where we kind of get him past a kind of feminist sniff test. So it was kind of other female journalists who might otherwise have said Labour needs a female leader. I was just very involved with how we could make it work. And this was back when Tom Kibbesi, former head of the IPPR, was his kind of unofficial wingman. And Tom made that video about that kind of pitch to the Labour members, in which he had these brilliant left-wing credentials. He was a steward on the Whopping strike. He was a kind of human rights firebrand. All the things that he denies being now, it was what he kind of went into battle on back in 2020. And I don't know if you remember that speech he gave at the beginning of COVID, when he was talking about the last shall be first, and using this very biblical language, basically, about kind of the low paid workers who the country had suddenly realised were the backbone of it, of everything good about it. Do you know what about it? I really kind of berated myself when the project kind of transformed into what it became, this kind of hyper cautious, what looks now like more of an austerity project. I really berated myself and was like, what on earth was I thinking? Why was I so gullible? Why would I find it so plausible I felt like I just projected onto him everything I wanted to see. And I felt like I understood him to be kind of Corbyn in a suit or competent Corbyn. And I really raked over what it was that made me think that, when that plainly isn't what he is. But you know what? I did loads of interviews around his constituency, and every single person said they met him and they knew immediately he was of their politics. And I'm talking about really different people, you know, kind of right on the right of the Labour Party in his constituency. One woman said she used to work for Len McCluskey, and Len used to come back from meetings with him saying, yeah, he's a really great guy, that Keir. He might not say X, Y, Z, but deep down he thinks what we think. Everybody sees in him what they want to see. He's got like some kind of Men in Black magic going on. And the only time I ever saw him in any way wrong-footed was when he was at that dinner I talked about at the very beginning with all these kind of female journalists, because he couldn't kind of give all of us what we wanted because we were all different. He seemed much more kind of unsure of himself than I've ever seen him before or since. But, you know, there is something about him. He's like, I'm not going to say he's a shape-shifting lizard man, but there is something. He is quite a zealot character. He will kind of bend himself to what he thinks you want to hear, to his own advantage. And I mean, all I can say to that is he's much, much cleverer than me, because it took me like years to figure that out. And I still don't know whether
he's sort of leaned out of that now, right?
Yeah.
In that kind of moment and conjuncture of 2020, like, you know, wins the Labour leadership, he was a kind of sponge for other people's ideas, and other people kind of were so desperate in the Labour Party and Labour movement for some kind of ray of hope for their politics that they were just sort of prepared to think, this is him, this is Starmer. I guess my question to you, I mean, I've only met some of like the characters from the Starmer world, you know, once or twice and stuff, you know, the people from Labour Together who are seen as like having a lot of power. What were they like? As you said, you know, you were quite involved in the Labour leadership campaign, Starmer's Labour leadership campaign originally. Did they give much sense that they were coming with a different kind of set of politics and ideas to the table?
They've never had, I still can't tell you what their ideas are, Luke. That's what's so weird. They have these kind of passionate belief in the importance of winning. You know, we're the Labour who like to win. We're the Labour who hate losing. but I cannot tell you what their actual programme for change is. I can't tell you what their analysis of capital and labour is. I can't tell you what their true beliefs are on climate crisis and the kind of speed of transition. I cannot tell you what their thoughts are. And, you know, I've like spent time with Morgan McSweeney, and all I remember was this kind of absolute laser-like focus on the exact composition of the Labour Party and what it would take to win its members round. You know, it's like this percentage of them are classic Polly Toynbee Social Democrats, this percentage are Corbyn diehards, this blah, 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 blah. And I remember being really impressed at his command of the data without really thinking it through. He was quite plainly saying they're a bunch of trots and we just have to find a way to play them. And I didn't really hear that until it was too late.
I think the other thing that I kind of notice is that a lot of that kind of ecosystem and community of, I guess, Labour right, Blairites, for want of a better term, I mean, a lot of them come from like a kind of communication professionals sort of world where they're kind of around public relations, and they don't have much kind of rooting in the rest of society. It's a slightly strange sort of almost schizophrenic kind of world in a way, because your whole job and title is communicating to the public. But to any sort of regular member of the public, you would be considered sort of quite odd. It's not like a kind of part of the Labour Party where you could say, oh, you know, well, look, they represent stuff. They can kind of draw in like the Muslim community or the trade unions or this and that. It's like they don't have a kind of societal sort of foundation. And I guess they are just, you know, by the nature of the job and working in and around the private sector, just sort of much drawn much closer to capital.
I love the way you put that, actually. Their one job is to mediate between what's supposed to be complicated political messaging and your average layperson. And I don't know if you went to Labour conference last year.
No, I didn't. I haven't been for a few years, actually. What was that like?
Well, it was so striking. It was so striking. I mean, I just feel sad even describing it. Like, it wasn't just that there was like loads and loads of suits, that the world transformed seemed kind of sad and underpowered, kind of conference proper was like incredibly ideas free. It was ideas free. It was debate free. It was, they knew they were going to win, but you didn't get much sense of celebration and joy. I mean, it was really, really depressing. And the thing I really noticed was, like, suddenly, and this was the first time I'd seen this since 2015, if not before, the place was full of suits, you know, those young men who, they found out a way to charge £1,000 a day. Nobody else knows how they do it. And they're very, very happy with themselves, but they don't, I can't tell you what their politics are, and I don't think they could.
I mean, I guess that, like, one conclusion there is that they're not necessarily that organically Blairite. I mean, what's your sort of sense? I mean, Tony Blair and Tony Blair Institute doesn't seem to have that much of a kind of centrality to this Labour Party. Or
the Tony Blair Institute is definitely quite central to Wes Streeting's operation. And if you think, as I do, that Wes Streeting has been kind of building a shadow leadership challenge team for ages, since before they won the election, not a challenge, but like a successor, he's kind of framing himself as successor, then the Tony Blair Institute is extremely central to the operation. It's central to the next chapter. Now, I don't know, have you heard Tony Blair on the radio lately? Because I don't think we can really talk about Blairism anymore, because he's Tony Blair 2024 is so different to Tony Blair 2003 and so different to Tony Blair 1997. They might as well be like completely different people in completely different parties. Tony Blair is completely surrendered now to the language of kind of immigrants as a threat to our national cohesion. He's completely surrendered, as far as I can see, to this idea that the wokerati is somehow the dangerous force in society rather than the hard right.
Yeah, I suppose if you hang around with billionaires enough, you do end up sort of adopting the kind of new billionaire ideology, which, you know, people focus in on Elon Musk, but it's something, I guess, a bit broader than that. This idea that Musk is kind of a totem for it, that, you know, the idea of the wealth creators sort of strategically aligning themselves with the identity politics right wing factions, right, and sort of triangulating, that does seem to be a thing that sort of goes much further beyond Muskism. Let's get away from the sociology of big capital and Tony Blair, and I don't know how we got there. Labour won the election, or did the Conservatives lose? You were covering the general election quite a bit, right? I was trying to zone out of it as much as possible. My sense from the result was basically that the election result had, you know, quite decent grounds for optimism, really, in some ways, if we're using that metric that we like to use on this show quite a lot. It's kind of a decisive defeat for the Tories, but it wasn't exactly a decisive win for Labour, and it certainly showed that they have competition and pressure in society and now in representative politics to some degree from their left as well. So
I think people, like, the phrase used a lot at the time was a broad but shallow victory, right? So they did everything they needed to get every single seat that they possibly could have got over the line they got, but all those margins were quite thin. And I don't really, I'm not sure how much store I set by things like that, because the truth of a general election is it doesn't get recontested for another 5 years. So unless you've got like Boris Johnson in charge and everybody's mad, but in fact, even then. And so, you know, even a broad and deep victory isn't necessarily going to last 5 years in this day and age when things are quite febrile anyway. What I did notice, and some people thought this was strategic and I thought it was more meaningful than that, was how many people only just got themselves over the line who were really central. You know, they really thought people like Jess Phillips, people like Wes Streeting were obviously going to win their seats because they were such huge figures. They're such like leading lights of the party. surely they, more than anyone, would romp home. And they were winning on handfuls of votes, you know, three digits. And that was because I think the left did have more of a resurgence than they were expecting. And that, you know, there was a lot of chatter afterwards, which didn't really get much traction, about the kind of pro-Gaza voice and then the pro-Gaza activists being intimidating to Labour MPs. But I think that's just a complete red herring to a deeper point, which is there is kind of energy around alternatives I can't remember seeing before.
No, definitely feels different in that sense. I mean, you know, knocking around like the spheres that for a long time under the last Labour government were trying to set up alternatives to Labour. God, it was depressing and bad. And I think just lacking a kind of, in the end, just not enough people, I suppose, was like, is one feature of that depressingness and badness, right? That in this instance, there's genuine kind of societal support that links together anti-racism, opposition to Islamophobia, migrant rights, with a kind of economic social justice agenda coming from society. And I think that's what's kind of encouraging about those, at least some of those independent like campaigns, right? They really came organically out of communities around those politics. And I don't know, I suppose now I think everyone is getting terribly depressed. I guess one thing that Prime Minister Starmer has really, and Chancellor Rachel Reeves, have really like set out to make people as doomy and miserable as possible. And I just wonder how much of it is kind of vibes. I mean, if, you know, Morgan McSweeney is right, and this is how you win the 2029 general election or 2028 general election, then, well, it's certainly a left field kind of strategy, right? Because it's just kind of saying, don't expect very much from us. And things were terrible over the last 14 years, and we don't have much chance or hope of them getting better. So it's really like desperately trying to lower the horizons. And the reason that I focus in on the communications of it is that I do think that that's important, because they do have progressive good things that they are doing that they could talk about. You know, the workers' rights agenda, good. You know, public sector pay rises, great. You know, a new publicly owned energy company, fantastic. Big investments in solar farms, you know. So they have lots of things that they could be talking about, but they want to really instill a sense of misery in the general public.
So first of all, there are different characters in the government, right? And I think we're kind of not used to that. If you think about, and also Keir was always really, really strict in his messaging from the minute he became leader. He didn't want anybody to build up a profile or a personality or a kind of vision, kind of brand, a vision brand outside of his own leadership, which I thought was a mistake. I always thought that was a mistake. But as we've seen, he does not listen to me. But even while they haven't really been allowed to build up their brands, Ed Miliband is really, really popular with people who know about green energy transition, with his staff, with people who know about the voice he is in cabinet. He's really popular. You can't find anybody to say a bad word about him. Not that I'm looking for people to say a bad word about him, but it is important, I think, to recognise that he doesn't make a huge noise about it. But the young left-wing firebrands who work for and around him think he's great.
Ed Miliband, Angela Rayner, you know, they're getting on with doing progressive stuff in government.
Angela Rayner, yeah. We wouldn't necessarily know that was happening, even if there wasn't a kind of playbook to make us all miserable, just because it's not a very collegiate government. It's a very kind of leadery government, which again, you know, I think is a mistake. But anyway, it's especially with the green stuff. I do look at that and think, this might be good by accident. In terms of fuel payment as well, I'm not against cutting the pension of fuel payment. I'm really not. Like a quarter of pensioners are millionaires. There's a lot of very rich pensioners out there. And okay, maybe they've put the boundaries in the wrong way, and maybe the means testing needs a bit more finessing.
Oh yeah, they could have easily like cut the it as a universal benefit. I guess the problem is they chose the most stingy criteria possible, which is pensions credit. So I guess What's the best way to describe that, like social security for people who aren't of working age, basically don't have other sources of income, private pensions and so on? So you're really talking about like the poorest pensioners. So the fear is that those who are just not quite the poorest and just above that threshold will really lose out from this policy. But of course, at the same time, the pension's going to go up. So the pension will increase, will more than wipe it out. But so it seems like it's become a very big thing. But compared to something like not lifting the two-child benefit cap, it doesn't really compare for me.
It doesn't really compare for me. And I think that's actually, it's more interesting as a test of the media environment and the sheer brass neck of the Conservatives than it is as an example of Labour policy. Because they, you know, the Tories, did you see that protest they had on Parliament Square?
No, I didn't see that.
Oh my God. It's like these Tory MPs kind of standing there, like outraged about pensioners cast into penury after 14 years of the most breathtaking cruelty and callousness to those on the lowest income.
Yeah, for sure. Not the pension vote, you know, did do okay out of the Tories, you know, the triple lock and everything, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's just outrageous. I think the unions are making a mistake.
So just to reinforce like the sense of the vibe shift from July to wherever we are now, middle of September. And so YouGov published a great bit of comparative polling like not so long ago, a week or so ago. And it compared how long it took a new government to get to a position where only 2 in 5 people said that they approved of the government. So in 1974-79, Labour government, it took 2 years. 79 to 97, Conservative government, it took 2 years. 1997 to 2010, Labour government, of course, took 11 years to get to that level. And in 2010 to 2024, so the last Tory government, it took 6 years. Now, Prime Minister Starmer, whose team are driven, as we were saying earlier, by public opinion, winning is their shtick, it took them just 2 months to get to that level. So I think when I saw that, I found that really helpful because I was wondering, is this me? Is this like the bubble that I'm in? How far does this sort of disapproval, you know, go and this sense of misery? And I think it is something a bit broader. You can say what you like about the winter fuel payment and everything, but that is a lot of pensioners. It's a lot of voters. They tend to vote and everything. So I think that there is something wider in society that's happened here in terms of public opinion. And it's going to be really interesting to see sort of where it goes from here. My sense, looking forward to the budget, is actually it might not be that bad. They've built up this kind of misery, 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 tough choices, it's going to be really hard, don't expect anything. And then you'll get to the budget and they'll probably be relatively progressive tax rises, probably equalizing, you know, capital gains tax with income tax and stuff like that. Maybe they'll pull a wealth tax of some description or increase taxes on wealth through inheritance out of the hat or something. So kind of redistributive fiscal policy, maybe a few cuts here and there, but probably overall fiscally expansive budget. But I don't know if that's your sense. They're certainly building up the austerity, austerity, austerity narrative. But I just wonder whether that's like trying to create a narrative that things are going to be terrible. And when things aren't so terrible, people are like, oh, that's all right. It's not so bad.
The thing is, and I found this increasingly with so many terms, but I don't think austerity is a very good word, right? Because we use it to mean anything that is fiscal contraction rather than expansion. So anything that isn't a new pay deal for public sector workers, anything that isn't an uptick in the pensions or in benefits, anything that isn't infrastructure spending on NHS, we call austerity. But actually, in conservative hands, they were often spending more money just to be cruel, you know. But the benefit sanctions regime cost more than it saved. The fact that they were chasing benefit fraud and they were never chasing white collar fraud, that cost more than it saved. Even Atos, there is a kind of is a little bit contested, but putting people through the ringer for those PIP payments cost an astronomical amount when they outsourced it. So they weren't really saving money. They were spending money in order to flag that people shouldn't rely on the state anymore. And so I don't think when we say, is the Labour Party austerity Mark II, it's never going to look exactly the same as the Conservatives' iteration. And it's never going to have the same arithmetic because so much of that was kind of underhand. And then, you know, remember, since 2016, that government didn't really do anything apart from respond to crises. Austerity was kind of for the birds in terms of as a kind of concrete, fixable policy.
I think you see that as well in the kind of left response to some degree. You know, there's always this kind of cyclical thinking that happens on the left. Basically, the idea that you always fight the last war and generals fight the last war and not the war that's happening now. And it's kind of inherently the case that if the Labour government has, as they have done, given thumping pay increases across the whole public sector, the likes of which no one has seen for, you guessed it, 14 years, then it's kind of inherently not the same. So those aspects of austerity that might still be in there, so if they hold down spending on local government, on all departments outside of health and education and military and defence, which they might be inclined to do, that will still be a kind of form of austerity if they keep to Tory spending commitments in those areas. It's already not the same as the Tories that just left.
Exactly. I think local authorities are going to need a massive cash injection, right? Because I think it was something that when Birmingham went bust last year, or was it the beginning of this year? A huge number. At one point, I think a quarter of other local authority heads were talking about their own anxieties of exactly the same thing happening. Now, there's no way a Labour government is going to say, okay, go to the wall, you brought it on yourself. So there's a lot of spending down the road, which is only going to come as a result of a crisis. So they can't plan for it. That's why I don't really take budgets that seriously. The stuff that really costs money is never the stuff they saw coming.
Well, I think that's what's going to be, for me, really interesting about the budget, because I just don't feel that they can not increase investment in critical areas. So, you know, do they really want, like, the news stories of a load of councils in London going bust, as the association that represents London councils has warned? You know, do they really want the news stories of financial crises in 7 or 8 different UK universities that, you know, could well occur, like in maybe June, July, August, like next year, serious financial crises? What happens to those students? They have the data to know that these risks are there, and they're about to do a budget. So surely if your whole, like, agenda is long-term thinking, we're working over a 4 or 5 year plan, surely you don't want to be in those crises, unless you're just going to say, oh yeah, these crises are a simple illustration of how bad the hand the Conservatives left us. I mean, of course, they can argue that, but I just feel it's really difficult for them to do that if they've had a budget, you know, spring statement or something. They've got their hands on the money, it's up to them to what they do. So I just don't think that they can sustain that argument for as long as they might think they're going to try and do. What's the new word on the street around the corridors of The Guardian? What do your colleagues think the budget's going to look like?
Well, I mean, the people who are really into the Labour government think it's going to be fine, and the people who are really not into it think it's going to be a bloodbath.
Well, that's the thing. There's so much preference formation in, like, how people are reading this stuff. It's just kind of difficult to get to the substance, the reality of what's happening.
I think you're right, you see. I think they're not... It fundamentally is a different kind of project. So the Tories, I think, were happy when crises happened, because they would justify the slightly bubbly, aerated politics that really suited them and kept them in power. You know, every time something unbelievable happened, it seemed to strengthen them and strengthen their disaster narrative. And, you know, go back to Naomi Klein and disaster capitalism for a rationale for that. It does suit people who like volatility to kind of bring it on. And these people do not like volatility. They, you know, I think broadly, even if whatever their politics turn out to be, I think they want stable, predictable government. Whatever their conception of society's best interest is, at least that's what they're going to try and do, right? The prisons are a case in point. Talking about your honeymoon period stats, if you look at Keir's first actions coming in, you'd think the answer he'd been, you'd think the question he'd been asked as he came into office was, what shall we do with all these empty prisons? I mean, there's a kind of surge of people going to prison. But in fact, the opposite was the case. Prisons were already at breaking point, and now they're past breaking point, really. I think on Tuesday, there were 100 spare places across the entire estate, or 200. They're really, really in crisis. And they cannot, there is absolutely no way they can make a plan in this budget for the even the top five most likely crises, whether that's the winter strain on the NHS, whether that is, as you say, universities, whether that's prisons, whether that's local authorities. The budget doesn't exist that can meet an emergency in all five of those perfectly likely areas. You know, it's perfectly likely that any one of those areas will be in an emergency within the next 3-4 months. So I think if we've got any sense, we should look at the budget really more as a guide document than the kind of soup to nuts on what their actions are going to be, because times are very febrile. And at the risk of doing their work for them, the Tories did leave a fabulous mess, technicolor mess. And it's really difficult to say what you're going to get bitten by.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So what do you think about where the left critics of Labour HQ are at the moment inside and outside the party? I was thinking about that, and I, in a way, I'm not really sure, because on the one hand, you have, I guess, you know, looking at the formalities of it, there's a lot of success. There's all the independents that have been elected. There's the breakthrough for the Green Party. There seems to be a kind of the Labour left and Labour MPs, I guess, have been disciplined to the point of impotence to some degree by the very, very authoritarian, I think constitutionally pretty unprecedented. I mean, certainly unprecedented in my lifetime to have such an aggressive whipping operation. People say that Tony Blair tried to do it in the early 1990s, but couldn't get away with it on his benefit cuts at the time. And a lot of them are really like trying to emphasize, I guess, the glass half full, the positive progressive stuff. And I think the overall picture becomes quite fragmented in terms of where is the left? What party is the left in? Maybe it's not in a party. What does the street movements look like? The trade unions look pretty happy with what they've got so far, so probably won't be a source of real mobilization against the government. So I don't know. I don't know if we're in like a kind of interregnum, to use that phrase, you know?
It definitely feels more like 2010 than any other period. So if you think about like you and me, not necessarily any concrete positive action we've done, because I couldn't name one. I'm sure you could. But, you know, in terms of the vibe, between probably 2015, when, as soon as we got the referendum date through, and 2019, so that's 4 whole years, was kind of full-time mobilising against Brexit, trying to get it reversed, doing anything that we could. It turned out fruitlessly. Prior to that, there was a lot of energy around Corbyn. Kind of a lot of that ran concurrently with the Brexit mobilisation, even while those kind of aims turned out to be contradictory and mutually sabotaging. But I really remember in 2010, that kind of really dirge-like dead time when we'd have like kind of marches against the cuts, but we hadn't really seen the cuts yet. We didn't really know what they meant. We hadn't really made our peace with who the government was, so we still thought they could be appealed to on conscience grounds. We didn't realise that cruelty was part of the point. There was so much we didn't realise, and there were so few figureheads around, you know, what the real fight was. everything kind of felt kind of aimless and slow, like a little bit dreamlike, a little bit sludgy. And I feel like that now. I don't know where it's going to land. And it's like, until you know where it's going to land, it's impossible to know how to mobilize against it. And, you know, they might. I interviewed Led by Donkeys the other day, and I just hadn't, and I've always really been amused by and diverted and admired their stuff. But I hadn't really got to grips with how incredibly cool they are, those guys. You know, they've got a history of direct action going back to their teens, a lot of them. They've completely put me to shame. I kind of think of myself as a real firebrand because I went to Greenham Common, and that wasn't even my idea. I was a kid and my mum made me. But, you know, they've like so many cool things they've done. They've climbed oil rigs. They've got in the sea in front of a drill ship. They've done hunt sabotage. Like, they've been really working full time in kind of concrete, measurable actions. And they are completely, you know, they wake up every morning knowing exactly what they want to fight and fighting it. So when they talked about kind of Labour, I sort of listened to them in a way that I kind of often don't listen to our own side. They were like, well, you know, whilst we're going to still carry on doing what we do, fighting for humanity towards refugees, blah, 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 end the war in Ukraine, end the genocide in Gaza. But hopefully the Labour Party will be a bit more receptive than the Tories were. And I suppose I feel a bit like that we just got to keep doing what we do, but just hope the environment is better and it's going to land on more fertile ground. But I don't know whether that's true.
The Economist published, like, maybe a week or a couple of weeks ago now, an interesting op-ed opinion piece. Why is the UK's pro-European movement, anti-Brexit movement, like, so weak and so invisible? And it was quite an interesting, like, tour through some of the arguments, because from an outsider's perspective, in an interesting way, right? So I think, you know, for people who were involved in it, the answer is obvious: demoralization, pessimism, a general sense that things aren't happening. And it sort of like made me pause to think about, well, what is the source of the weakness? Because they made the quite interesting observation, very much an outsider's observation, that if they were the Labour left, they would strategically prioritize the pro-European cause, even if they didn't believe in it particularly strongly, because it is a gift to hit the Labour leadership over the head with. And of course, what the benefit of an outsider's perspective sometimes is that that's completely true. Like, I mean, that would be a strategic, tactical ingenuity of the Labour left, but it just is not going to happen. It's got about as much chance of happening as a month of Sundays. You know, it's just a completely not going to happen at all. And I guess it tells you something about the pro-European cause in a way, because for Euroscepticism, it was always, and it became particularly after, at least after the Maastricht Treaty in the 1990s, it was kind of organically connected to the rise of the authoritarian far right over time. The further right in the Conservative Party you went, the more Eurosceptics you were going to come across. And of course, the pro-European cause isn't like that at all. I mean, vast majority of people who are bound up in the pro-European cause, who joined the marches and the organisations around it, were firmly in the centre ground of British politics. And if you want a simple explanation for why there isn't now much of a pro-European movement or much activity around it, the simple explanation is, well, their guy is in number 10, but has said no thanks to the movement. We're going to stick with, you know, Brexit, and not even, it seems, in at least in their current negotiating positions, not moderate it.
But did you see the OBR's projections for, like, into 2074? They basically project spending to outstrip tax receipts by such an astronomical margin that everything has to be reimagined. And John Harris, who I don't agree with on everything, but I did agree with this, said on Blue Sky, this is a revolution in the tax system. And I wouldn't be surprised if that didn't look like wealth taxes down the line. And I'd be in favour of that. But B, everybody knows we need to get back in the single market. It's like everybody knows that. The reason I'm not campaigning or doing anything constructive towards that is that I'm completely burnt out, you know? On that one issue, I'm not burnt out on anything else, but on the issue of Europe, I'm completely spent. But it is one of those weird things. Everybody knows we have to do it, but everybody thinks somebody else is gonna get the ball rolling. And I think it might need clean skins, you know. It might need people to come in who kind of weren't in the game in 2016.
Well, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because everyone in the Parliamentary Labour Party knows that that's true as well, right? What you said about the single market. And everyone in the Parliamentary Labour Party and in the government privately would have that position. Okay, there'll be a handful of actual pro-Brexit people, but basically, as far as it's anything credible is concerned, there is basically zero, you know, pro-Brexit sentiment in the Labour Party or Labour government. So it's sort of this, it's this, what do you say to that? Like, be braver, stop being terribly opportunist, stand up for what you believe in. And by the way, you say you're promising economic growth. Well, I mean, it's not Royal Road to economic growth, but it's one of the clearest and most basic levers you have to get a bit more economic growth. Pull that lever. I mean, that's all, that's what you need to say. But they know that. So it's a strange one. It's like, what is persuasion in that situation?
I think, I mean, I'm enjoying how psychoanalytical you are today, because I think there is something really interesting about, you can't be persuaded of something that you're already persuaded of. But in a way, we've got this kind of Stockholm syndrome where we've been able to see how senseless it was for so long that we kind of don't expect anyone to see sense.
And that is the legacy of the Tory government, isn't it?
But did you ever read that Miranda Carter piece on Kaiser Wilhelm?
No, I didn't. I must have missed that one.
Well, she wrote a biography of Kaiser Wilhelm, and that was really good too. But she wrote this really great piece about how actually Kaiser Wilhelm's real legacy was the woeful politics that came after he died. It was the combination of like packing the institutions of government with yes men and cronies, destroying trust in institutions and public life, and, you know, bad decisions. The combination of that had such a long tail that, you know, you could see it echoing into a world war before you could see it fading. I think, you know, in order to not have that legacy of Brexit, in order to not be living in the legacy, not just of lower growth, poor productivity, an absence of a ginormous trading partner, but also a kind of a surrenderedness, a defeatism, a kind of sense that even though we know what to do, none of us can do it. We really need to kind of take that on rather than just exist in it, because entropy doesn't fix itself. You know, at some point you have to go in and clear it up. Thank you.